Good evening and welcome to the Center for Strategic and International Studies. I'm Andrew Schwartz. I'm our Vice President for External Relations, and I get the pleasure of standing in for my boss, John Hamry, who wanted to be here tonight but couldn't. And I wanted to thank all of you for coming out on a rainy night where traffic's tied up, because you're in for a real treat, and this is a great session. I want to thank our partner, Texas Christian University, TCU, the Schieffer School of Journalism. There is going to be no better school in this country for journalism than the Schieffer School.
We're getting there.
We're getting there. And that's because of this man, Bob Schieffer, and our friends from TCU, Dean David Willick is here. Vice Chancellor Larry Lauer is around here somewhere. He never sits down, but he's here. And with that, I'd like to throw it over to Bob.
Thank you very much, Andrew, and thank you. May I also say thank you, because we thought the traffic would be such a mess that we weren't sure anybody would show up tonight, so we're really glad to have you. This is about new media and public diplomacy, and I hope you'll have some questions ready, because this is something that I'm going to learn as much about this as those of you here, and I'm sure there are a lot of you here who know more about it than I do. It's something new, but it is extremely important, and we really have some important people in this movement right now. Jim Glassman, he was Under Secretary of State for Public Diplomacy and Public Affairs and Chairman of the Broadcasting Board of Governors, which, of course, as you all know, oversees all non-military, taxpayer-funded international television and radio broadcasting by the government. He was at the American Enterprise Institute for 12 years. He has been the publisher of The New Republic, president of Atlantic Monthly, executive vice president of U.S. News and World Report. So, bottom line, he knows what he's talking about when it comes to publishing and journalism and public policy. Jared Cohen joined the Secretary of State's policy planning staff in September of 2006. He was the youngest member at that point of the Secretary of State's policy planning staff. He is now on the current Secretary of State's policy planning staff, where he is again the youngest member of that group. He's a Rhodes Scholar. He studied at Oxford. He got his BA from Stanford. He advises the State Department on the role that technology can play in advancing foreign policy objectives. Shervin Pishavar is the founder and CEO of SGN, which is one of the leading social and mobile gaming companies, with more than 11 million installs on the iPhone and tens of millions of users of Facebook. He was the founding president and COO of Webs, which is formerly FreeWebs, one of the largest social publishing communities in the world with over 30 million members. Serves on the board of directors of both SGN and the Webs. And you are Persian. You're from Iran. Yeah. And you grew up there. Yes. Juan Carlos Zarate, our national security consultant at CBS News. And before that, he was the deputy assistant secretary to the president, deputy national security advisor for combating terrorism from 2005 to 2009. He was responsible for developing and overseeing implementation of the U.S. government's counterterrorism strategy, and he played a big role in getting the State Department interested in new technology and the things that can be done with it. Jim Glassman, let me just start with you to kind of set the stage. What exactly is public diplomacy?
Well, public diplomacy is diplomacy that's aimed at publics rather than at officials. And it is an attempt to inform them, to engage with them, to understand them, but most of all to influence foreign publics in pursuit of American interests. So that's the kind of the standard definition of public diplomacy. And the means by which public diplomacy is exercised tends to use vast amounts of media. But it's also very important that it be done in a personal way as well. And the State Department has been doing this for at least the last 60 years.
Jared, what is new media, and how is that used now? Because certainly this is a big part of the public diplomacy era.
Well, and it's actually an exciting question, an interesting one, because the term itself has actually evolved. I mean, the term that we now use is connection technologies, and what we mean by that is technological tools like the internet and cell phones that also give you access to the internet that connect individuals to information, i.e. new media, that connect individuals to each other and entities, i.e. social media. And the most exciting and recent example of this is technology as a tool to connect people with actual resources, be they financial, as is in the case with mobile banking, be they judicial, as is in the case with telejustice, which is probably the newest form, education, as is the case with distance learning, or health, as is the case with telemedicine. And this, to me, is really one of the most exciting trends, because it's no longer about technology as a tool to communicate and message only. It's about technology as a tool to empower people for development purposes, empower people for diplomatic purposes, to have a tremendous civil society impact across the board, not just political, but also in terms of upward social, upward economic growth, for instance.
Sure, but I want to talk to you especially about the Iranian opposition movement and how they have used the internet to help organize. But the Iranian regime has not only repressed this movement, but it has limited access to the internet. How's that going? What's the situation in Iran right now, as you understand it? And how is new media being used, or is it being blocked by the regime?
Well, in Iran today, 56% of the population is under the age of 25. And so most of that population has grown up with the internet. And as of recently, the mobile penetration rates have gone quite high, the highest in the region. And if you look at what happened in June of last year after the elections, most of the pictures that you see in Iran and the videos that you see mobile cameras up taking pictures and taking videos and then uploading those videos to YouTube and the internet for the world to consume it. And I think that was a pivotal kind of inflection point within the country, of the youth suddenly being empowered in the way that Jared has talked about, of realizing that through connection technologies and through the internet that they can actually communicate with the rest of the world. The obvious reaction, as you said, is to try to clamp down on that in a sense similar to what China has done in terms of blocking internet access, blocking telecommunications access, mobile access. And so what's happened is by rate limiting the connection of people through their mobile and through internet connections to sites like Facebook or Twitter or YouTube, the obvious response to that is to try to find solutions, to try to build tunnels around that. And so I think the trend that we're going to see, and we've talked about this, is the beginning of basically mirrored networks that are not blockable by governments. And that, I think, in our history is going to be a pretty big pivotal point in terms of empowering people. So it's not just that you have a device that can capture what's happening. If you imagine in Tiananmen Square, if those mobile cameras were there in Tiananmen Square, we would have a record of what happened. In the same way, with Netta, we have a record of what happened. If you connect that with the possibility that there can be connections to the internet that are not filterable, that are not blockable by governments, then you have true freedom of expression around the world. And I think that's kind of the next phase of technologies that are being created.
So you see the private sector is playing a role in all of this.
So I would say private sector, but also public in the sense that individuals who have incredible talent in the technology space are volunteering their time in a crowdsourced fashion to create technologies that are exactly as I talked about. And when that happens, it's very familiar in the sense of even in American history, the kind of the desire to be free. And people are using tools and techniques that are in that spirit of revolting against regimes that are
but you know, there's also a downside here, mm-hmm. and one is now terrorists can talk to one another. They can find one another, and I think we saw this with the Christmas bomber.
Oh, that's right.
Who had been talking to this cleric there. We saw it with the shooter at Fort Hood, who had been talking to somebody. So we're in a very new and different world now, aren't we?
I think you're absolutely right, and I think we have focused often with how the bad actors end up using the technology. And we have to remember the technology is neutral from a policy perspective and with respect to morality. Certainly terrorist groups, Al-Qaeda and others, use these technologies to communicate, to fundraise, to radicalize, to recruit. But I think what we're finding now, and as we talk about public diplomacy in the new digital age, is trying to think about the other side of the ledger, which is how does the U.S. government, how do private sector actors, how do individuals, civil society, how do they use these technologies to actually promote interests that are in alignment with U.S. interests? And frankly, that's what we tried to do and started to do, I think, at the end of the Bush administration, where we thought of counterterrorism in a slightly different way, especially when Jim Glassman came aboard at the State Department. The question was, could you use this new environment where one individual could have a huge amplifying voice, the ability to communicate from one to many using video and other technologies, the reality that governments weren't the only voice anymore, and in fact weren't credible voices. If you look at whether or not people believed what President Bush said or Karen Hughes or Jim or Juan Zarate, you know, we weren't credible voices in the question of ideological extremism. And with respect to the ability of individuals to create a sense of global connection, where one individual in one country could connect with others around the world, became very important. And I think there really is one event that I could point to that really awoke the national security complex to this possibility. That was in February of 2008, when one individual, a guy by the name of Oscar Morales, Jim, Jared know well, used Facebook to organize what was to become the largest anti-terrorist demonstration globally ever. He brought out 11 million people in 183 cities around the world to demonstrate against the FARC. And at the time, that was significant. In one respect, we witnessed the use of the technology in a very powerful way. But secondly, we, on the inside, were looking for ways of affecting the moral debate about the role of the FARC in Colombia, which has taken numerous people hostage, and at the time still had three American hostages in custody. And this was powerful. It then led to demobilizations. It led to a whole series of actions that ultimately led to the release of hostages and a whole host of other issues. So I think we need to look at these tools as precisely that, tools to affect our national interests. And a big part of that is the role of the private sector.
So, Jim, what do you see right now as the biggest challenge? What do you think is the most effective way we can do this, and how do you evaluate how it's being handled?
I think the biggest challenge is actually spreading the technology. The more people in places like Iran that have technology that's working in their hands, that's not being blocked by government, the better off the cause of not just freedom and democracy, but even American security is. And I think this is happening right now. And I think it's happening fairly rapidly. And my own, if I have a gripe myself, it is that we're not doing enough. That is to say, we as a government are not doing enough in Iran, especially, to spread the technology and to provide the kind of moral support through these networks that we're talking about to the Green Movement. Now, let me say very quickly that I'm not in the State Department now. I have no special knowledge. There may be lots of things going on that I don't know about, either secret or not secret. But I'm just urging this government, as well as the private sector, to get going, because this is, in my view anyway, the best hope that we have to forestall a nuclear weapon in Iran. That's how important it is right now.
The best weapon to forestall that.
Well, I think that this is just my view, that the chances of some sort of diplomatic solution that's going to prevent Iran from getting a nuclear weapon, I think the chances of that are kind of slim. I hope they're not, but I think they are. And I think the chances of military action, maybe they're growing. They may be growing every day, but they certainly are quite frightening. And that instead, by using the tools of public diplomacy and strategic communications to help a movement, which unfortunately didn't exist when Juan and I were in the Bush administration, but does exist now, I think that there's a chance that this movement can either change the regime or change the regime's behavior in a way that will be positive for global and American security, and certainly for the for democracy and for freedom in Iran. And I really do believe that it is this technology that we're talking about that can do that. That's
so
how
what
important
exactly
it is.
Are you doing on that front, Jared?
Well, I think I think the best place to start is the Secretary of State's big major policy address on internet freedom that she gave in January. But before I even go into that, I mean the seeds for the kind of policy that you're seeing on this today were actually planted by these two gentlemen right here. I mean, I often, you know, when people ask about this new kind of startup diplomacy that's looking at using technology as a tool across the board, I often use, you know, Jim Glassman and Juan Zarate as an example of the U.S. government's version of the Google garage, right? As kind of a mini operation, they early on, especially in the last 6 months of the administration, began asking these questions of, you know, can technology be used as a tool to enhance civil society?
But let me just say, we don't want to make this too much of a mutual admiration society, but Jared, I would not have been asking these questions. I would not have been doing these things without Jared Cohen. And Jared was my mentor in these activities, and I think Juan would probably say the same thing. So, you know, we put them into effect, but really it was, I think it was this team that you see up here on the stage.
But the important thing is that there's actually, you know, people often talk about government being behind the curve. When it comes to technology applied to foreign policy challenges, I would actually argue that it's a rare instance of government actually being with the curve. I mean, if you look at, you know, the so let's go back to the Secretary's speech in January. She gave a 45-plus minute speech making internet freedom a top priority of the administration, something that had never been done at that level in that kind of a venue before. And so the question you have to ask yourself is why was that policy decision made? And the answer is, you know, going all the way back to the previous administration, in particular the last year of the previous administration, you know, the traditional set of stakeholders who were advocating for human rights, civil liberties, basic freedoms at the grassroots level, you know, continued to do their work. But what we saw with the advent of these new virtual commons was an extension of the civil society that we used to be familiar with. Civil society has always been everybody, but because of barriers that are related to age, gender, socioeconomic status, circumstance, we previously hadn't had the opportunity to, you know, see groups emerge from virtually nowhere to achieve a tremendous impact, like the FARC example that Juan gave. And in particular, early on in this administration, whether it was Iran or Moldova or the Uyghurs in China, we saw a demand on the part of this broader definition of civil society taking their advocacy into cyberspace. And cyberspace is not something separate from the traditional civil society that we know. It's an extension. And so, you know, our feeling inside the government, and in particular the Secretary of State's feeling, was if people are taking their advocacy into an extended version of civil society, then our policies that are empowering them, protecting them, and enhancing their ability to get around things like human rights violations, politically motivated censorship, you name it, need to also expand to a broader civil society. And so that was the first step. Now the phase that I would say we're in at this moment is, one, proving the concept. That is, you know, going beyond the traditional associations of technology with, you know, just public diplomacy or just, you know, public affairs, and making it part of counterterrorism, making it part of counter-narcotics, making it part of support for democracy and good governance. And so there's a huge institutional challenge here. And government is, you know, more than ever just one of many stakeholders. So, you know, if you look at statecraft as basically a formalized way of troubleshooting, when you're troubleshooting anything, you want as many different stakeholders in the room as possible. And so we're increasingly engaging the private sector, not so much just for commercial purposes, in fact, less for commercial purposes, and we're asking them to take off their commercial hats and put on kind of part-time diplomatic hats and applying their technical expertise in the room while we start troubleshooting, you know, a variety of challenges across the board. And Shervin's certainly been part of a number of these.
Well, Shervin, talk to us a little bit about how the opposition in Iran used these various new media. And what were the things that they used? Was it Twitter, Facebook?
It's you know, if you look at it as a Swiss Army knife, all of the tools that were used were you know, really invented and created in the past few years, 3 to 4 years. So Twitter, and our friend Jack Dorsey created Twitter, ironically, out of his fascination as a young man when he was like 16 or 17 with short messages for emergencies and ambulances and things like that. And he, you know, he always thought about, well, how could I use short messages for humans to communicate in short bursts of information? So that's actually been one of the more important tools. If you also add social networking tools that have been created, like Facebook, to organize people and communicate together, the movement in Iran obviously has used these. You look at also email, Gmail, all of these things. At the same time, that brings a lot of risk, because once a government can actually hack into these systems, they can get a lot of sensitive information about who's in these movements. And there have been instances of that happening that are, shows the bravery of the individuals that are involved in this. They're putting their lives on the line for freedom. So that's that. Back to just want to connect the dots with Jared's point. We just came back from a trip in Russia, and we had the CEO of eBay, John Donahoe, Jack Dorsey, the creator of Twitter, Padmasri Warrior, the CTO of Cisco. Because of Jared reaching out to the private sector, and back to this point, it's actually one of the rare instances where the government has been ahead of the curve. I'd say the private sector has been behind the curve in the sense of using and understanding the role that we could play within public diplomacy. So it's not just us creating services and letting them go into the wild and evolve, but also engaging us in the process. And that trip was, I think, for all of us, an eye opener in terms of the role that we could play.
Well, let me just ask you that: what is the situation in Russia now in regard to the internet? And is it an internet friendly place? I want to ask all of you: what do you think about China right now? But what's it like in Russia now?
Well, these two gentlemen were just there, so they have the best perspective.
I mean, Russia is a fascinating place vis-a-vis technology. I mean, the internet is now 40%. Penetration in Russia. Siberia is the fastest growing market in the world. But more importantly, if you look at innovation, during the Cold War, and this was really one of the main premises of the trip, during the Cold War, innovation between the U.S. and Russia was viewed as a zero-sum game. If they innovated, it came at the expense of us, and vice versa. Now, as we enter into a new chapter of U.S.-Russia relations, innovation is perhaps our greatest shared resource. And so it offers this huge opening and opportunity for us to actually engage with Russia as partners on a variety of issues. Now, that's sort of one operating assumption. The other operating assumption is, if you take traditional civil society type issues, education, health, anti-trafficking, anti-corruption, we have limited progress, really, in a lot of places in terms of, advancing our partnership and tackling these issues down the field. But the hypothesis for this trip is, what if we make the point of entry innovation and less these civil society issues? And so the idea of bringing a delegation of CEOs from Silicon Valley to talk about anti-corruption, health, education, and anti-trafficking goes back to what I said about statecraft being formalized troubleshooting. Russia's in the midst of this major modernization debate right now, where they want to build the next Silicon Valley. And so they embrace this set of stakeholders with open arms. And because this was the particular set of topics that we discussed, we were able to come away with 20 different deliverables in each of those, funded by the private sector, executed by the private sector. Now, President Obama has been very adamant about a strategy towards Russia that focuses on dual-track engagement, meaning we engage not just governments and societies. Part of what we were trying to do with this trip is demonstrate that we don't just engage with Russian societies, we're also going to bring our society to engage with Russian government and civil society so that it really is the true spirit of a partnership. And neither U.S. government nor the Russian government had really ever had a conversation about any of those topics that I mentioned, specifically thinking about how technology can be utilized to come up with innovative solutions for each of these. And there was a mutual enthusiasm on both sides, but it's also a model, right? Classic statecraft of just government-to-government relations, there's still a place for it, but if we want to actually develop multi-stakeholder initiatives to address major multi-stakeholder challenges like the ones that I mentioned, then you need to also do multi-stakeholder diplomacy, which we call 21st century stakeholder.
I think this is just remarkable because Jim Glassman and I are probably the only people here old enough to remember this, but I can remember during the Cold War when the Soviet Union, there were no telephone books for security reasons because they didn't want people to be able to contact one another and know where they were. And so they had no telephone books. And to hear this, I mean, I find this rather stunning.
Well, I'm glad you were not talking about Tsarist Russia.
I was there for that. But no.
Bob, if I could just make a quick point, because I think Jared is really on the cutting edge of this diplomacy, but there are edges to this. In two regards, there's two challenges, I think, to the U.S. government. First is a bit of a bureaucratic question, but it's also a fundamental question. How does the U.S. government enlist the private sector in a more activist way? It's a public diplomacy, not of the traditional type, but of the type where you have the CEOs of technology companies not only joining you on these missions, but perhaps even strategizing with you as to how to advance U.S. interests across the board. The second question is one that we've already seen this administration come up against, and that is, at what point does this digital age and the technologies associated with it abut against other interests? You saw a bit of reticence with respect to supporting the green movement with some of these things. I think it's now an open secret that our good friend Jared here made a call to Jack Dorsey to make sure that Twitter didn't take down their site right at the height of the green movement. That was a pivotal moment, but that was a call from Jared to the CEO of Twitter, not a government policy. In fact, he got in trouble for it. But you've also seen it with China in two regards. The reaction to Secretary Clinton's very important January speech, where the Chinese bristled because they saw it as an invasion of their sovereignty with respect to what our perception of internet rights should be. And secondly, you see this playing out now in what I would term a low-grade cyber war between Google itself and China, where these very principles are underway. And so I think we're in a very different landscape here, where the U.S. government is still feeling its way through how to deal with the environment and how to leverage what is, in essence, a real potential amplifier for U.S. national security interests.
We want to get to the China thing, and I'm going to ask about that next. We want to go to some questions from the audience, but let's talk a little bit about this Google deal before. So be thinking of your questions, and we'll talk about that a little bit. Jim, I would just like to get the assessment of the panel here of the action that Google took. What did it mean, and what is its significance?
Can I, before I answer that question, I just want to add to what...
No.
Yes, of course. Well, you're tough. In this sense, I do think there is still a very important role for government, and I agree with everything that Jared said in this area. And I've been particularly disappointed that this government has not done anything about the fact that the Iranians are jamming a commercial satellite, a commercial television satellite that is used to broadcast BBC and Voice of America into Iran. This is in contravention to law, to international law, and it's not doing anything. It's not stepping up to do something about it, to complain about it.
Is there anything we can do about it?
Of course there is.
Is there?
Of course there is. And so I'm just saying there are certain things. I loved Mrs. Clinton's speech. I think Secretary Clinton has done a terrific job, and I'm very happy that she followed up on the Alliance of Youth Movements, which was something that that Jared and I and Juan helped create. And she's done a terrific job. But I think that there are things the government can do to promote freedom of communication. And I'm just using broadcasting as one example, one of many examples. Yes, there is a very important role for government. Now, as far as Google and China is concerned, I think it's a very difficult question, a very difficult question. And I'm not going to come down on one side or the other. I think a good argument can be made on both sides that Google, as a company that's trying to encourage freedom of communication in China, should be out there doing as much as it can and to say, well, you know, we're fed up with what the Chinese are doing. That may be a retreat. On the other hand, it may force the Chinese, the hand of the Chinese. So I'm going to be neutral on this question. I'm happy to see Google standing up for principle, however.
Jared, what's your take on it?
Well, you know, it's interesting. This is the whole Google-China issue is a sort of rare instance where, you know, the actual talking points for this are actually very important, because Google-China was an example of, you know, the shared responsibility of preserving internet freedom between the private sector and the U.S. government. But we have an internet freedom policy at large. We don't have an internet freedom policy towards one country. The reason I mentioned, sort of made that facetious, slightly facetious comment about the talking points is all the talk in the news and focus on Google China was a great opening for us to talk about the larger and much more diverse challenges of internet freedom. It gave us a chance to talk about the 31% of the world that accesses censored internet. It gave us a great opportunity to talk about, you know, the girl in Saudi Arabia who was killed in an honor killing for being caught using social networks, an example of normative challenges beyond just legal ones. It gave us an opportunity to talk about imprisoned bloggers, the full range of this. And so, you know, thank you, media, for latching on to something that gave us a platform to follow up on the Secretary of State's speech and broaden the conversation about internet freedom. One of the most important things, going back to Jim's point about censorship, there was something in the Secretary of State's speech that was a major policy shift that I think was of tremendous importance. I mean, the U.S. government has long provided support, either financial or logistical, to entities that are working to help get around internet censorship or other forms of censorship. This was the most open and forthcoming we've been about it. And the Secretary was very, very clear in her remarks that, you know, it is the policy of the U.S. government to engage and empower entities around the world that are helping populations get around politically motivated censorship. You know, now as we look for ways to do that, not just for the internet, but a variety of other connection technologies, I think we're entering into a great moment, because her articulating that at such a high level in such a high profile setting, we hope is going to bring people like Shervin out of the woodwork. You know, because again, it's a shared responsibility. Government can only do so much. I mean, the internet is a shared resource. Cyberspace is the largest ungoverned space in the entire world. You know, government can only do so much, and this is a great example of the role that the private sector can play.
So one of the things that I said in the dinner with Secretary Clinton was that the last bastion of dictatorship is the router. That's basically like that. That's our kind of digital Great Wall and Berlin Wall. And so I think the greatest thing that we could accomplish in the next 5 years through public sector and private sector and just tapping into the talent that's out there is to figure out technologies that can essentially get rid of that last barrier. And once that barrier is down, I think there's going to be so many surprising things that will happen in terms of societal shifts, especially in these types of regimes. The one thing that I want to push for, and I've, you know, talked to Jared about this, is to try to create an X Prize for internet freedom. To put an award out there to tap into the creative talent of technologists around the world and to come up with new technologies like the ones that we've talked about to basically get rid of the ability of governments to filter the internet, to jam stations and open up these channels of communications that are not blockable.
Yeah. I was just going to say, I think it's a fundamental question for the U.S. government as to whether or not what was articulated in January, which was an important speech, becomes policy, and whether or not we're going to see a 21st century version of the Berlin airlift globally in a cyber basis. Is there a cyber Berlin airlift that the U.S. government actually promotes with the private sector? And I think the Google-China thing is very interesting and important for two reasons. One, it represents a classic engagement between the private sector and an authoritarian regime in a way that is open and notorious. Secondly, it's on the terms of two issues that are of national security import to the U.S., freedom of speech and cyber warfare. Because part of the reason Google made this decision is they had enough with cyber hacking as well as the restrictions on the internet. So I think this is an important instance, and I think we're going to be looking back on it as one of the seminal events in the 21st century, in the early parts defining this era.
Let's go back and talk about the underside of this, as it were, and the fact that it is available to terrorists. Yep. You know, the thing that strikes me as a journalist, and the thing that has changed journalism, is that the internet is the only vehicle we have ever had to deliver news, and now it's on a worldwide scale, that has no editor. The worst newspaper has somebody who knows where the stuff came from. But things pop up on the internet, as we now know, and nobody knows where they come from. You don't know if it's true, it's false. Right. We found out in the mainstream media the real impact of this really on 9/11, when we knew all the airplanes were on the ground, and yet things would pop up on the internet and say, there's another plane headed toward the Sears Tower in Chicago. We would have to stop everything we were doing, go back, check that out, and report that that was not true. Now, in traditional journalism, it has always been that if you make a mistake, it's your responsibility to correct it. If your competitor makes a mistake, you simply ignore it and wait for him to correct it. You can't do that anymore, and that journalism now is not about that. It is about knocking down false reports. For example, after Sarah Palin went on the ticket with John McCain, there had been all these vicious stories and rumors and so forth about Sarah Palin that were churning around on the internet. Now, no mainstream media printed any of that or broadcast any of that until the McCain campaign put out a written press release and said, you know, her 17-year-old daughter was pregnant. And after that, we were all checking on it. We were all trying to figure out what to do with it. And that's what we find ourselves doing now. This stuff churns around on the internet, and both the politicians and the news media, the responsible media, are trying to figure out how do we handle that. And I think probably our job from here on in is going to be to put down false rumors. That's going to be the main job that we have. But one, how do you deal with this in government, and what are we doing with it from the standpoint of these terrorists? Because there's no question, they are in communication with another now. These nutballs are in communication with one another in this country. And if they're doing that here, they're certainly doing it in other places.
That's right. No, and you see this, and this was a topic of deep frustration for the Bush administration, the idea that the narrative of the enemy was not being challenged, that we were being outdone by the very technology that we had invented. And I think in some ways the discussion today has been sort of, again, on the other side of the ledger, which I think is important because it's been a missed component of national security. But I think we have to be honest with ourselves that the elements of this new environment, the ability of one individual or a small group of individuals to communicate globally, to give a sense of global community, to give the sense of a virtual caliphate in the context of Al-Qaeda, to put out rumors or innuendo and build a narrative, works to our disadvantage as well if we're not able to compete and challenge and knock it down. And by we here, this, again, the third dimension of this, the government is not necessarily a credible or flexible or good voice in this debate. And it's something we had great challenges with. You know, putting out talking points from our ambassadors or the president or Jim Glassman doesn't do the trick with dealing with a viral message or a viral video that may or may not be true from Al-Qaeda. And so I think we're still in the early stages of understanding this. That said, I think competing on the basis of ideas is our strength. And I think Al-Qaeda has suffered when they have tried to engage in the dialogue of this new media. You think back to the Ayman al-Zawahiri question and answer period on the internet, a two-parter that he had. He suffered and Al-Qaeda suffered mightily in terms of their image because he was unable to deal with the dialogue on the internet, to the questions about the moral legitimacy, for example, of killing Muslim civilians. And so I think we've got to find ways of harnessing the technology to compete on the battlefield of ideas, understanding that you're not going to be able to stop all the crazies, that you're not going to be able to stop necessarily all the lone wolves who are radicalized, but you can compete in this space, and it is the private sector in many cases that has to be a partner in it.
You know? I was going to second what Juan said, that, you know, in a Web 1.0 world where there is a kind of broadcast or one person standing here talking to a lot of people kind of paradigm, it's true that the terrorists are in pretty much the same position we are. If they're sending out messages, you know, do this or this is how I'm going to indoctrinate you, fine. But when we move into a Web 2.0 world, which is a world of a broad and deep conversation where there are lots of networks and there are lots of people participating in the conversation, this is what terrorists hate. What terrorists want to do with young people is indoctrinate them, isolate them, bombard them with messages and exhortations like a cult does. But once you open that up, they are at a major disadvantage. And that's why I think that in a world of social networking, we those of us who believe in freedom and testing messages, testing whatever the truth is, we're on top. And the second thing I would say is that I really do think the government has an important role here. Juan talks about narratives. You know, there is a very pernicious narrative out there that's tremendously powerful, and we need to counter that narrative. And only government can do that. Can't do it through government actors. It needs to do it by mobilizing others. But we need to be out there doing that. That is not something that the private sector can do.
This is one of the most important policy questions that's actually out there right now. This question of, isn't technology a tool that can be used by bad people to do nefarious things? And it's something we grapple with in government all the time. It's something I get asked about multiple times every single day. And there's three rebuttals, as I see it. And I'm not a tech utopian by any stretch of the imagination, but I am a pragmatist. The first rebuttal is it's already happening. Mexican drug cartels use video and technology. Al-Qaeda set up a mobile phone brigade. I mean, there's so many examples of technology used to coordinate, to recruit, to propagate, and so forth. The second, so that's already happening. The second is the most important and pragmatic, which is this isn't DARPA creating the internet anymore. Whether we like it or not, Google, Apple, Cisco, Facebook, where all these companies, big, small, and medium sized, are putting this technology out on the public domain. And so that kind of leaves us as policy people with two questions or with two possibilities. We can fear that we can't control it and decide we don't even want to try to influence it and just remove ourselves from that situation. And this is what Juan and Jim are getting at. Just give the enemy more space to exploit these tools to propagate their messages or recruit. Or we can recognize that the 21st century is a terrible time to be a control freak and know that we can't control it, but we can influence it. And there's no better time to influence it when internet penetration in countries is 24%, 28%, cell penetration is 50% or 60%. I can tell you the Iranian government understands this perfectly. You go to Herat province in northwestern Afghanistan, and it's the most connected province in the entire country. There's cell towers everywhere, there's electricity towers everywhere, and right next to every single one of them is a nice Iranian-funded mosque, an Iranian-funded school, an Iranian-funded charity. So they are bringing influence on their terms. And then there's a historical argument, which is the third one, which is we said the very same thing about the cassette tape in the 1970s, the tape for Walkmans. We didn't want to engage in that space because we feared the Soviets would use the cassette tape to propagate a communist ideology. We neglected the fact that it was the private sector putting it out there, and our removing ourselves from it wasn't going to limit the proliferation of this technology. And so not only did the Soviets grab onto this and utilize it, but had it not been for the cassette tape, it's very unlikely that Ayatollah Khomeini would have been able to achieve the kind of fanfare from his villa in Paris to achieve the kind of notoriety in Iran that allowed him to come back to such fanfare in February of 1979. And so that's a useful analogy for sort of an older generation of skeptics. But this is really the most important debate of time, because the critics will say, they're all tech utopians, technology's bad, all these things. And it's not tech utopianism, it's pragmatism. And so an example people often say is, what about the blogger who gets arrested? And I say something very controversial when asked about this, which is, nobody gets arrested for blogging, people get arrested for dissent. Right? To me, a blog is an example of a sort of 21st century version of a newspaper that has a URL or website instead of an office, that has followers and members instead of a paid staff or a group of writers, and that uses open source platforms instead of having to rely on some completely non-media related company to buy 60% share and keep it alive. This is really important. Go back to what I said at the beginning, that technology or cyberspace is an extension of traditional realms. And when people say things like bloggers get arrested or imprisoned or this person got in trouble for using technology, it's an extension of the civil society we know. It's not about the technology. What happened in Iran wasn't about Facebook or Twitter. It was about the people behind Facebook and Twitter, your non-traditional leaders that technology created a platform for that for a variety of reasons wouldn't previously have had any ability to articulate a voice. And if I could just say one more thing, and then I'll shut up for a second. The best example of this is the Nada video in Iran. Somebody 5 feet from Nada Sultan captured a video on his or her cell phone, SMS'd it to somebody else who SMS'd it to somebody in the diaspora. Within an hour, it had gone viral, had thousands and thousands of repostings on YouTube, and that video changed the rhetoric of presidents and prime ministers around the world. Without technology, do you really think that somebody standing 5 feet from Nada Sultan would have been able to influence some of the least accessible leaders in the entire world in basically real time? It's a question that I leave you with. Again, technology is not the answer, it's a tool. And it's a tool that is often relevant, not always relevant, but there's always a risk that comes with it. You'd be hard-pressed to think of a single example in which technology is being utilized where there's not some sort of risk. So the sort of policy question is you know, the juice worth the squeeze? You know, it's a cost-benefit analysis.
Jervin, would you like to
add? Your point.
And then we'll have some questions from the audience.
Bob, your point was, it reminds me of the famous Norman Rockwell painting of the rumor mill, of one person saying something and then passing on. By the time it reaches the 15th person, it's a totally different story. And my kids love playing that game when we were at dinners, and we by the time it goes through five or six people, it's a totally different line. So I think what you're touching on is that, and I've written a little bit about this, and I call it kind of the overtly present, which is we're bombarded with so much information, and out of that can come confusion. But what we're finding is that the rate of corrections that's being done by the public when something is spread, whether it's purposely rumors being spread, and we saw this in Iran as well, where kind of government agents use Twitter accounts to kind of spread the wrong information. All of that is corrected in real time. So I think as Jared's talking about, is that there's far more positives to that confusion when once people correct it. There's way more positives that it leads to. So.
All right. Questions? Yes, sir. Would you like to come up to the? And identify yourself, if you would.
Peter Scharfman, MITRE Corporation. I'd like to return to the subject of public diplomacy, which we began by defining as a deliberate effort to influence foreign publics. Doesn't that clash with the idea that the 21st century is a terrible time for control freaks? Wouldn't we be more influential if instead of worrying about getting our message precisely right, getting the talking points drafted exactly, we just broadcast out the cacophony that is our own domestic politics?
Who would like to answer?
Let me answer, because I agree with you. I mean, I emphasize influence because there's a reason we do public diplomacy. We don't do it just for the fun of it. We do it in order to achieve the national interest. People sometimes forget that. So how do we do that? We try to get people to agree with us on things and move in the same direction that we want to move in. Now, what's the best way to do that? To simply stand at a microphone and preach at them doesn't work. To generate and facilitate a broad conversation in which we have a role or our views are expressed, in my view, that's the best way to do it. And toward the end of the Bush administration, we developed something called Public Diplomacy 2.0 that embodied this kind of approach, that said it's not working when we preach to people. They're not listening to us. They're much more sophisticated than that. And you know what? That's not really American anyway. That really doesn't reflect who we are. Who we are is people who believe in a marketplace of ideas. And so let's use technology. And again, Jared's right. Technology is a tool, but it happens to be a really good tool for public diplomacy 2.0. Let's use things like social media to promote this conversation in which our views or ideas that we think are important to achieving the national interest can get expressed and heard. And sometimes we in government are not the ones who are expressing this. But the conversation itself is important to take place. And so that's what we try to do toward the end of the administration.
Bob, can I just add to that? Because I think that's right, but I would add another dimension, which is it's not just about the marketplace of ideas, I think, but it's about being activist in terms of networking and empowering those in civil society who are using these tools who align with our interests. And so one of the things we looked at very carefully in the counterterrorism, counter-extremism context is there some way of building a global grassroots counter-movement to this ideology? Al-Qaeda is trying to create a global movement. Where is the counter-movement to this? And we tried that with the Alliance for Youth Movements, you know, supporting groups like Sisters Against Violent Extremism, trying to support victims of terror groups. It's a group now called the Survivors Global Network. There are groups out there who are aligned with our interests but who are not voices of the U.S. government. And I think that's a very important part of statecraft in the 21st century.
You know, I was sitting with Jared one day and just saying, you know, here's my dream. Can't we, couldn't we help generate an anti-violence movement that would be somewhat similar to the movement that developed among young people in the 60s? Would we be pointed against terrorists? Would we be pointed against the people who are causing all this violence in the world? And it was kind of a silly dream when you think about it that way, but in fact, that is what has developed, not necessarily because we've done that much, but because networks have sprung up, some with our help, some without our help, that, and many of them involving young people, who are standing up against this violence. So yes, I think that can happen.
Back here.
My name is Hugh Grindstaff. Mine's not so much a statement, but I'm now looking at a Facebook page of a friend of mine who's with the Public Diplomacy Office in Afghanistan, and she's talking about building a peace and friendship garden in Ghazni province. So that's one example, a definite example of where your guys' work is getting out there, but who's this getting to? Is this getting to the everyday Americans who want to know what's going on, or do they really care about it? Thank you.
Well, you know, it's what I'm taking as your question is, you know, is technology just a tool for the elite, or is it just a tool that helps us reach a domestic audience? And my answer, it's a very valid question. My answer to that question is, don't pay attention necessarily or just focus on the statistics of who has access today. Pay attention to who's going to have access tomorrow or in the next week. So I look at trends, not sort of current day statistics. So, you know, if you look at access to the internet in 2000, it was about 300 million people. Today, not that many years later, it is about 1.8 billion. Cell phones, there's 4.6 billion cell phones on the planet today. The penetration in terms of percentage is even greater because a lot of families share cell phones. You mentioned Afghanistan. Afghanistan has 24% cell phone penetration. The prediction is that by 2012, it's going to be up to 72%. Somalia is another example. The most organized and stable thing in one of the most organized and stable things in that country is the telecommunications networks. The cell phone penetration is astronomically high. And finally, let's take Pakistan. Everybody would agree that Pakistan is a major foreign policy priority and a critically important country on the globe. In the year 2000, Pakistan had 750,000 mobile phone subscriptions. The country is roughly 160, 165 million people. Anyone want to guess by just 2008 how many cell phone subscriptions they had? Anybody have a guess?
132,000.
78 million cell phone subscriptions. So from 2000 to 2008, they went from 750,000 cell phone subscriptions to 78 million. Now, not only are more people getting access, but what you can do with this technology is even greater. So you ask, you know, who is it reaching? There's only one country in the entire world where security forces are receiving their salaries over cell phones, and it's Afghanistan. You know, because where there's the greatest challenges, you can often find the greatest innovations when you just sort of throw tools in there. In Wardak province, police officers, through a partnership with Roshan Telecommunications, are receiving their salaries on time in their entirety, and rather than deserting or abandoning their posts for 2 weeks to go physically deliver their salaries to their family, they just SMS transfer it. And by the way, in order to make that legal in Afghanistan, a telecom law had to be passed making SMS a legal document. So not only does mobile banking exist now in Afghanistan, but you have the ability for people to potentially use SMS as a document that holds up in a court of law for video testimonies or SMS testimonies where you can hide people's faces and disguise voices, which can be tremendously empowering for women. So that's a long answer to your question, but the short answer is, we're getting there really, really quickly. And you know, the argument that you know there's limited access is actually just incorrect by virtue of statistics. But it's increasing exponentially every single day. And the digitally connected few can be a powerful tool to galvanize and mobilize the non-connected masses. And we've seen that in Colombia. We've seen it in Iran. We've seen it across the board.
Question here.
Traditionally, I guess it's state, and as you stated with Secretary Clinton talking about open internet, something comes down from the top, people parse that information, it turns into policies. And what's happened with the new technology in a disruptive way is that you've engaged communication, and you've mentioned that this is a tough time to be a control freak. All of you folks have obviously led this process. Can you explain what it's been like or what you've encountered as far as opposition to this change within the work you've been doing?
Who would like to?
Well, I can give a little anecdote. I think leadership on this stuff matters, and I think, again, continuing the Mutual Admiration Society, I think when Jim came on board, he was not only the right person at the right time, but had a vision for this. But one of the things we were doing even before Jim came on board was we assembled within the government a very motley crew bureaucratically at the White House to look at precisely this question, to see what types of initiatives we could seed at a minimum to see if these kinds of ideas would work. And it was folks like Jared and other folks from the State Department. And we had to be unusual and unorthodox in the bureaucracy of this because there wasn't an established process for this. There wasn't an established hierarchy to kind of give the command and everyone went forth. And so in some ways we had to kind of seed these ideas in unconventional ways. And I think that was the way that we, like insurgents on the inside, sort of got around some of the classic bureaucratic hurdles.
Yeah, we started the first, what we believe to be the first social networking site the government, the United States government ever started. It's called Exchanges Connect. Very sort of benign subject matter, which is exchanges, educational exchanges. And but it was difficult. There was definitely opposition within the State Department because we did not control, as government, the space inside a .gov site. People could get on that space and talk, as they did, about Gaza, what was going on in Gaza. They disagreed with it, disagreed with American policy, that sort of thing. But I found that, you know, when we really pushed it, that that the lawyers and others who had some reservations in the beginning began to understand this is important to do. And there's nothing like leadership coming from Secretary of State, and our Secretary of State was very much in favor of this, and the new Secretary of State is doing a great job as well. So it really does come from leadership, but there is, I think, an impulse within the bureaucracy to want to control, and it's very difficult.
Over here.
Hi, my name is Katie Alberts. I'm a master's candidate at George Washington University and also an intern at the International Broadcasting Bureau. My question is specifically for Mr. Glassman, but as well anyone else can address as well. You suggested that something must be done about the jamming of BBC and VOA by the Iranian regime, as it is a violation of international law. And recently, as I'm sure you know, VOA's Amharic service into Ethiopia has been jammed as well. What do you suggest specifically that the U.S. government do about this?
Well, first of all, understand, thank you, and thank you for your service. IBB is doing very important work. Look, I mean, you know, jamming's been going on forever, and the Chinese do a real good job of jamming. The Russians have their own sophisticated way of jamming, which is to kick American stations, American stations off of private networks. Everybody does it in a different way. What the Iranians are doing right now is something that is unprecedented, as far as I know, which is that there is a commercial satellite called Eutelsat that is broadcasting, as any satellite does, many dozens of channels down to people who have receivers on Earth, including in Iran, and the Iranians are jamming, and they're jamming an uplink to that satellite. And to my knowledge, nobody's ever done that on a consistent basis, and nothing is really being done about it. The BBC, the head of the BBC Farsi service said, and I'm just paraphrasing, look, if we can't stop them from doing this, how are we ever going to stop them from getting a nuclear weapon? So I think this is very serious, and there's something that can be done. There's certainly protests can be made, even if nothing can be done legally. Certainly something ought to be done in public to try to stop this. And we talk about new technology. The fact is that broadcast is not new technology, but it is having a tremendous influence in Iran. That Voice of America, BBC, Radio Farda are having a big influence because it allows people in Iran to find out not just what's happening in the rest of the world, but what's happening within their own country. So the free flow of this information is absolutely necessary, and I don't think we're doing enough to preserve it.
All right. Well, that brings us to the end. Thank you all very much on behalf of CSIS and TCU. Thank you for being here.